Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey there, this is Jeff Tomei. Thanks for the interview. You're listening to Whatever Nevermind. I'm here making records still.
I'd like to welcome to the program producer, engineer, and a mixer of all sorts of, I'll get into your artists here in a little bit, but you're here to talk about the Jerry Cantrell record. Of course, I'm talking about Jeff Tomei. I almost fucked it up there again. Jeff, welcome to the program. We're off to a rolling start here. I can't pronounce your last name, but I appreciate you coming on.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate the interview.
Before we get into the topic at hand, give me a little bit of your background, how you got into basically what you do, which is your in-studio work, kind of an all. Looking at your website and kind of doing some research on you, I mean, you handle everything from engineering to producing to mixing, correct?
Right. Yeah, just kind of do it all. You started off with, working in a studio doing cassette copies 36 years ago and kind of worked up and learned the trade. It was pre any kind of trade schools or anything like that. So just kind of learned it the old school way, being at the studio and figuring it out on your own or having some help with some of the engineers that were there.
And one of the early projects you worked on was the Smashing Pumpkins' Siamese Dream record with Butch Vig. Is that correct?
Yeah, 1992. So almost 30 years ago now?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Great record, though. Really
freshman
proud
year
of
in college when that, or second year in college when that came out for me. But yeah, Jesus. We'll share some memories from that. Like, what was it like working with Butch, Billy, before he was famous?
Well, Butch is who Butch is. He's not changed a bit. He's just a real chill. Was an awesome producer. Just a good guy in general. And it was a lot of pressure on the record because there was a lot riding on it. And to the contrast of that, Billy was not so easy to work with, but he's super talented. I can't say anything bad about him. He just was difficult to work with. He kind of had a goal in mind and it had to be that way. And that was it. So 4 months later, we had the record recorded.
any chance you have a story of being difficult you'd like to share?
Billy was really driven and some of the other bandmates weren't as driven as Billy and it turned into it's common knowledge. He played almost everything on the record other than the drums. So, and that was, again, that was due to, he had the vision in his head. It wasn't necessarily a bully kind of thing. It was just like, well, you don't have the part down. I'm taking it.
Okay.
Done. And this was back still in the tape days. This was recorded the 2-inch tape. So, Blade edited everything. It was, a lot of edits, a lot of cuts. But again, we cut 26 songs during that time frame, and I think 14 are on the record. And I don't know, four or five, maybe four made it on the B-side record, Pisces Iscariot. So it was a lot of fun working with Butch, and Butch has obviously gone on to do a whole lot more than what he had done prior to that. although he'd done Nevermind prior to that. So, and just a sweetheart of a guy. I try to talk to him about once a year and catch up a little bit. But, yeah.
Did he serve as like a mentor for you for a while or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, it was an awesome opportunity to be an engineer on that record. Butch is a very talented engineer in his own right. And so it was a great learning experience to do a record that was kind of on that level, you know, that was, I guess you could say it was the first kind of big record that I'd worked on. I'd been in the business for, I don't know, about 8 years and had the opportunity to do that one. It was, you know, an awesome opportunity.
And, well, Jimmy Chamberlain is just an out of this world drummer. Was he, a pretty quick take as far as getting his stuff done?
Yeah. Jimmy and Billy, they're both, you know, top notch musicians. And Jimmy, I mean, again, one of the super talents to work with because he's such an awesome player. He's, you know, they weren't easy songs to do, but he's just, you know, he was definitely up to the task. Again, without Jimmy, it was pretty much Jimmy and Billy with that record. James played a little bit on it. I think Darcy may have had one bass track that she cut on there, but I don't know if that's even right. Again, after this many years, my memory, I know Billy played almost everything.
Okay. Well, switching gears into why I have you on, coming in at number, I think it was 21 on the list, was the Jerry Cantrell 2002 record, I believe, Degradation Trip. Initially, my understanding is that Dave Jordan was going to produce it, but there was some, him and Jerry weren't vibing together at the time. How did you end up getting the producer seat for that record?
At the time, I had a manager out in Los Angeles, Aaron Jacobus, who was had been at Virgin for years before that, and Mercury and other labels. And it came across him, you know, it came across his calls or whatever that there was a need for that. And so he'd called me and said that what was looking to happen, that Jerry was looking to basically bring an engineer in to do it. And he said, "Would you be interested?" I said, "Absolutely." So within 24 hours, Jerry had me on the phone and just kind of described that it's going to be a long record. I want to do a double album. It's, you know, I started with Dave Jordan. I've worked with him before. He said it just didn't work out. He says, "I've got the band ready." It was Mike Borden and Robert Trujillo. And he said, "I just want to know, are you into doing it?" So it was that easy on that end of it. The first wave, I guess you could say, I was out for 12 weeks cutting tracks. I did a lot of traveling back and forth. I'm based out of a little north of Atlanta.
Okay.
And so, you know, it turned into a 10-month record, basically, on and off with that. And not long into it, Jerry kind of approached me and says, "You know, I need a co-pilot on this." He says, "I'd like to offer you a co-production on it," which was just, you know, to me, that was amazing. So it was, you know, a lot of challenges with that record. Again, a lot of songs we did. Some of the stuff was spaced out through the 10 months. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't this consistently, we go in and do the record and we're done. Jerry's just a super talented guy. Again, I've been blessed with working with some really talented artists, just from his vocal arrangements to his guitar playing to his songwriting. It was again, one of those experiences that really, really was great for me.
Now, what actually changed then as far as your role when you basically went from being just the engineer to now being getting a producer credit on it? Were you now more vocal in how songs were structured and arranged?
No, and right off the bat, it was more of a production role where put the record together. It was because it's just Jerry. Once we were done with the basic tracks with the drums and bass, it was Jerry that had to do everything else. Okay. And just to kind of keep everything going, keep things moving, keep forward progress, because it wasn't always easy. There would be days that he wouldn't show up to the studio, and, you know, just trying to keep within some sort of a budget, you know. So
he was paying for it out of pocket, if I read right.
He was originally on, he was on Columbia and was dropped during early part of that. I think after we'd gotten into it, maybe 6 or 8 weeks. And then he just said, "Well, I'm really passionate about doing this record. I'll figure out a way. I'm going to fund it." And he did. And then it sat on the shelf. We started the record in July. I remember exactly July 5th, 1999, and finished mastering and everything the following year in 2000, right around March. and then it sat on the shelf because he was looking for a label. So 2 years went by, and he wound up signing the Roadrunner. Roadrunner contacted me, DNR guy Monty Connor, and said, "We want to remaster the record. We're going to have George Marino do it in New York. Where are the tapes?" Because it was all, again, it was tape. We've recorded the tape. I did editing in Pro Tools, but when I mixed it, I mixed it all down to a half-inch two-track. And so it was like, okay, well, we have to find those. So, you know, a year and a half had gone by, almost 2 years, trying to find those tapes. And Jerry's management at the time was able to dig it up. The big scare was I got a call from the A&R guy, and he said, because there were 80 reels of half-inch tape, because I had some of the songs were long, there were alternate takes, alternate versions of mixes, all that stuff. So imagine 80 reels of half-inch tape that FedEx was going to ship to Sterling Sound in New York. And they said, the tapes didn't show up. And I said, you got to be kidding me. He said, do you have backups? I said, I have DAT backups, but we're not going to master off the DAT. And so fortunately, a day or two later, they showed up. I don't know. They got lost a minute in transit, but it was a little bit scary.
Wow.
Those are the master tapes. You realize that?
Yeah.
It's all we have. So
unreal.
Got it done. George Marino, who's, you know, amazing career as a mastering engineer.
His name is on half of my CDs.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was, that was a,
I got a bone to pick with him though, Jeff. He really fucked up that first issue of Kiss CDs. I had to rebuy a bunch of them when they fixed them.
Oh, well,
I blame him.
You know, CDs in general, man, when they first went from vinyl to that were a little rough. I mean, I'm a huge Beatles fan, and the first round of Beatles stuff were just awful. I mean, awful when it came out on CDs. So,
probably because George Marino did them. I'm just kidding. I have no idea who
George was amazingly talented guy. Again, I've been blessed in my career to work with some really talented people. So anyway, the record came out on Roadrunner, and Roadrunner's caveat was, okay, we're not going to put out a double record. And Jerry was adamant that this record needs to be a double record. It needs to be in the sequence it is. And they said, well, here's the deal we'll cut with you. Here's the compromise. We're going to put out a single record with, I don't know, 14, whatever songs were on the original. And then we'll do, as a tribute, we'll put out the double album at the end of the year. And they did. They followed through on it and put that out. So, you know, that's kind of how the layout went of that, and in the time frame to get, you know, get everything done the second time around, I guess you could say, because have it remastered. Because we had it mastered. Everything was done at the end of middle of March of 2000. It was done. Mm-hmm. But then it was just like, okay, now I got to shop labels. So we did.
How familiar were you with, like, Alice in Chains? And, you know, Jerry also had one solo record prior to that. Were you a fan? Was this something you really wanted? Or was it, you know?
Yeah. It was a great opportunity. When my manager told me that, it's like, wow, that's, yeah. Because, I mean, you think of Alice in Chains, what a landmark kind of band, kind of sound, everything to do with that. And then I thought his solo record, I love that solo record that he'd put out after the Alice in Chains stuff.
Boggy Depot.
Boggy Depot. Great record. It was I was very aware of who he was and what he had done. And I didn't know at the time who the players were, which was also a treat, because Mike Borden's has great history as a drummer with Faith No More, and that, and Robert, you know, Robert's with Metallica now, but he'd done all kinds of, you know, great stuff. He and Mike were both with Ozzy at the time, and they were on a break from the road. And Jerry had got those guys involved, and we did the record. But it was, you know, the challenge was Jerry handed me a couple of cassette tapes from day one and said, these are the demos, these are the arrangements, that's the tempos I like, that's what make that happen.
Okay.
And we're talking cassettes, and cassettes, you know, the cassettes vary a little bit tempo-wise, and there weren't any drums on it. So trying to figure out the arrangements and kind of the whatever, how many bars in the chorus, how many bars in the verse. So it's kind of hard to count some of the stuff, you know. So anyway, that was part of putting it together, and just, you know, part of the job.
On that real quick, because that sounds fascinating. So did you work with Robert and Borden without Jerry and just kind of like get these things laid down, or there was no like scratch?
Well, some days. I mean, the very first day in the studio, I show up at 11 o'clock in the morning. The gear starts showing up around noon, and Robert and Mike show up, and they're like, okay, they said, have you worked with Jerry before? I said, no. I said, well, he's a rock star. We just want to let you know. And I said, okay, whatever that meant. So 8:30 that night, Jerry shows up. So we've been there all day. Jerry shows up ready to go. So we go through, you know, a little bit, just trying to get sounds and kind of get everybody feeling good and loose in there. And but there were days where Jerry wouldn't show up, and it'd be like, okay, we've got to get this, at least get the bass and drums down on this song. And so we'd go through stuff like that. And okay. Sometimes we'd get a good scratch track of Jerry's guitar the day before on something we're working on. So I was able to use that. But, you know, it was not without its challenges.
Was anything written in the studio? It sounds like he had a lot of this stuff kind of planned out and what he was doing, but was anything like written while you guys were recording?
No, he had the whole record. He'd lived it and breathed it as in demo forms in his place in Seattle. So that was exactly what it was. I think there was one song, and I cannot remember the name of it, that we didn't get recorded. I think we wanted to do 26. We wound up doing 25 songs, which is a lot of material. Especially considering some of them, like Pig Charmer's 8.5 minutes long. So yeah. That's two songs in one. So,
well, what about the guitar tone? Because I'll pat you on the back a little bit here. You're going to have a hard time finding a thicker, better, just crunchy metal guitar tone. I mean, and it just fit the mood of the record. How much time did you spend dialing that in? And it's kind of a second question. How many layers of rhythm tracks are there typically on, you know, on the songs?
You'll get a kick out of it because it's so honest. Well, first of all, the guitar tone, Jerry shows up, and at that point he was playing through 5150s. But he had some, and I said, I tell you what a great guitar amp is. And I'd worked with a band just prior to that, Atlanta band called Double Drive. And the guitar player had just bought a Bogner Shiva, which is kind of their, I wouldn't say cheapest version, but it's their basic amp. But it's like an old Marshall. It's got EL84s in it, or EL34s in it, and that kind of thing. And he had a cabinet, and it was just the tightest, just awesome rock sound. So I said, this is what you need to try. And Jerry said, well, he says, I like my, you know, 5150s. He said, I've got these old Bogner preamps. He said, but they don't work. And I said, let's just get a guy to, let's rent one. And once he did, he says, I'm buying these. So he became a Bogner guy for a bit because, again, they were just, I'm still a fan of the Bogner Shivas. As far as layering goes, it's pretty honest. It's pretty much just left, right, and center. Lead track. There's not a lot of layers. We did maybe some clean stuff that are layered in there, but It was just straight up rock and roll, real, real honest kind of. I also discovered the Royer ribbon mic, which they just had kind of got going, and it's become just, you know, if you know anything about the ribbon, there it's the Royer 121, right. And they just, you know, the studio, we'd cut the record at A&M, which is now Henson. It was A&M then, but. And I was using their old ribbon mics, and they said, man, you're blowing up the capsules and blowing up the ribbon. You know, why don't you try these? The Royer company is letting us borrow some. And I said, as long as I'm not responsible, I said, I'm happy to try them. They said, you can put them right in front of a cabinet. And they did. And they were just, you know, that was where I got turned onto that. So that's a big part of the sound, too, is the ribbon mics are just beautiful on guitars.
Yeah, honest to God, Jeff, it is just a fabulous sounding record. And the guitar tones just punch you in the face. So.
Well, I appreciate it. And you know, we also had the luxury of we had a great guitar tech that I'd hired that I'd worked with previous. His name is Brett Allen, an Australian guy in L.A. And he had at one point, I bet we had 50 guitars. He had just some really nice, nice. And Jerry had a nice batch of guitars also. So between that, we just had so many choices and so many colors. Just to grab some. No, here's a 62 SG. Let's try that solo on She Was My Girl. Oh, that's great. Perfect. You know, that kind of thing. So that always makes my job easier from a sound standpoint.
Yeah.
And because, you've got such a palette to work with.
Yeah, that's what I try to tell my wife. This is why I need another guitar. I
of course.
I might just need it one time, but I have to have it. I swear I got questions specific to the record, but it's always fascinating in talking to somebody in your line of work. with mixing, obviously that's a big part of production, but I know some producers kind of will pass that task off onto somebody else. To me, isn't mixing one of the most important roles in production? I mean, well, what's your thoughts on that, I guess?
I would agree. I mean, as you go through the process, you've got your pre-production, then you have your tracking, then the mixing, and then the mastering. And every link in the chain, it should get progressively better. And it's interesting that I had actually had a discussion with Jerry towards the end of the recording. And I said, what are you going to do about mixing? He says, I want to keep it in the family. He says, I want you to mix it. So
nice.
Which was great, because a lot of times, you know, you do a record from whatever standpoint, and it's probably not necessarily a bad thing that somebody else mixes it, because they bring a fresh perspective. But I was so far inside that record at that point, it was really good to be able to mix it.
How many songs could you mix in one day?
I was mixing a song a day.
Okay, that's kind of where I'm going. I mean, you really spend a lot of time just on one song as far as a mix, correct? You're not like trying to get half a record done, you know, like in Punch the Clock.
Yeah, and the other thing is at that point I had I had before studios kind of had a common Pro Tools rigs in them. We cut it to tape and then we'd bounce it in and I'd edit. And we worked off of that. And then when I wound up mixing it, I took the dual 24 tape machines and bounced them to a 48 track digital, so I didn't have to lock machines together. But yeah, it was a song a day until we kind of, you know, we hit a stall where, because pretty much I mix it and Jerry'd come in and he'd, you know, make some comments and we'd sign off on it and move on, because this is still in the day where you had to recall the console. It was an SSL and you had to, you know, it wasn't like it is today. I can just open a Pro Tools session, make a tweak, and I'm done with the recall.
Right.
So we got to a point where I think I'd gotten to Anger Rising, which was the first single, and I didn't see him for almost a week. And so I just said, you know what, let's just bail on the studio for and save a little bit of money. And I said, I can't sit here and keep tweaking on the mix because there's nothing else you can do to it. So there were times like that. But again, mainly a song a day, unless it was something that was, like I said, Pig Charmer, which is 8 minutes, 8 plus. So it's a little bit of a challenge to kind of get through that. But thank God for automation. That's what I'll say.
do you like the way it's gone with Pro Tools, and it sounds like?
Yeah, you know, I my introduction into Pro Tools was on the – I did the first Matchbox 20 record. Hmm. And so my introduction was Pro Tools there, because I was a tape guy. And Matt Serletic, that produced the record, said, we're going to go into this new format. And I thought, that's kind of visual recording. I don't know if I want to do that. So
yeah.
Anyway, it was a blessing in the fact that I was able to spend the 3+ months on that record and learn how to use Pro Tools. And that was at 96. So that's that many years later, I've become a pretty, you know, pretty consistent Pro Tools user.
Yeah, of course. You know, I got to tell you, sometime I need somebody of your ilk to sit down and actually show me, like, back the old school tape where you would run a piece of chalk down it and a razor blade, you know, because, you know, I've done that in Pro Tools but, you know, you go whoops and you hit undo. You don't have that when you're taking a blade to a piece of tape. I toured Prince's Paisley Park studio, and that was the closest I got to one of the machines that showed how to that they used to do that. But I can't wrap my head around it, how effective that is. You know, I hear all these stories. I'm like, how are they not just jacking up most of the stuff they do? You could be a second off and it would be just a hair bit of tape, right?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, the tape machines are moving at 30 inches per second. So there's a little bit of leeway, but not much.
And, all right.
And it's interesting that I was just having this conversation with an artist yesterday, and he had a videographer, and the guy said something about Pro Tools and Smashing Pumpkins. I said, no, that was tape. I said, all that was blade edited. I said, as a matter of fact, the song Mayonnaise had so many edits in it, we had to actually transfer it because it was going to fall apart. The tape, because, you know, but the thing is, I was able early on in my career to start editing quarter inch voiceovers and get good with that. Then you move up to half inch. Then, you know, the first time I cut a 2-inch tape, it was, you know, really scared. It was really nervous. It's like, this is the master, you know, there's no undo nowadays. And the other challenge in that is just keeping track of, you know, so you take the chorus out of take 5 that you like on one of the songs. You put a piece of tape on it and stick it on the wall and let the rest of it just hang in a pile on the floor. So then when you get to that point, okay, I need that chorus from take 5. So it's just a matter. I don't think about it because you don't think about it because that's the only way we did it back then. It's all we knew. But now when I think about it today, it makes me kind of like nauseous. It's just like, how in the world did that ever work out?
It's like a teenager looking at a rotary phone.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I understand conceptually how it works, but I cannot for the life of me figure. It's like that has to get jacked up weight. But you hear these guys, oh, yeah, we did a ton of it on this one song. I'm like, man, I could see like one chorus or one solo, but Jesus, some of this stuff. But anyway, enough on that. Sorry. All right. Well, back to the record. The album kind of comes across as almost a concept record. I don't know if you can speak deliberately to this, but, you know, like it almost feels, knowing what we know now, because as we know, Lane died well after it was recorded and even after it was released initially. But it sounds an awful lot like a conceptual record about the life of Lane Staley.
Well, it was, I'll put it, I don't know that it was necessarily that. I know that it was a record written in out of darkness, drug abuse darkness, and whether it's Jerry's or Lane's or whatever, that's a lot of songs kind of point in that direction. And between that and some of the songs about the not necessarily the high times of a rock star's life, right. You know, so again, I don't know. I can't speak specific because Jerry and I never really discussed it. It's definitely a dark record. I mean, Mike Borden said it's like modern. It's a modern blues record. Was his take on it. Yeah. And again, yeah, his whole concept, all the way down to the sequencing of the album, because the double record that came out was exactly what the sequence he wanted before when it was still on, you know, cassettes. So Jerry had a vision for that and you know, finally saw it through.
When he was sequencing it, he was factoring in the idea that people were going to be flipping a tape.
Yeah, probably so. Again, I don't know the brain, his brain behind.
Okay,
that.
I was just reading into what you said there. So carry on. Sorry.
Well, yeah, I mean, but it was I think it was more of a flow thing, and I think it actually came from also from how he wrote the record originally and how he kind of wanted to flow from song to song and tell whatever the story is on it, you know. One of my favorite songs on the record is 3132, and it's a ballad song
that.
But it's so long and I've just racked my brains. It's like, it'd be great to get this song out as a ballad and get it down to, you know, radio link, but there was just no way to cut it without changing the story. And the story is all, that's what that song is.
I have something very specific to that coming up, so maybe you'll elaborate a little more when
okay.
I get there. But yeah, the one song, even the title almost just shouts, this is about Lane Staley was Bargain Basement Howard Hughes. You know, at this point, Lane was basically just a recluse. At least Jerry had been somewhat public with, you know, releasing Boggy Depot and working on this, so.
Yeah, he was... I mean, he was almost to a point where he was a recluse, and part of it was because he was not physically able to really get around anymore.
Yeah.
So he had abused himself so much.
Did you guys actually talk about Lane very much? Did you know anything about what was happening behind the scenes at that time?
Not a lot. I mean, Lane were brothers, and so in that respect, and so he had obviously a high regard for him, but he didn't really discuss it much. There was one at one point when we had some mixes and stuff. I remember Jerry had left for a weekend or something and actually took it and played stuff for Lane, came back and said, you know, he really dug it. It was, you know, he was real proud of and all that kind of stuff. So that was kind of a nice thing because, again, I've got a lot of respect for the talent of all those guys.
Oh, yeah.
And what they were able to do. It's interesting because he had some old demos of some stuff that they did prior to Alice in Chains, and we were playing them in the studio without Jerry before he came in, and it was like, oh man, this stuff's bad. This sounds like bad. It sounds like Rat or bad metal or whatever you want to call it. And so I remember this engineer, the assistant engineer on the project, was a good friend of mine. He says, here comes Jerry. He says, stop laughing about it. And I says, no, I'm going to laugh about it. And Jerry came in and says, yeah, it is funny. It's pretty bad, isn't it? Just like any band. No band starts off great.
Exactly. Everybody's got their growing pains. You should be able to laugh at yourself.
Yeah, right.
You hear that, Paul Stanley? It's okay. You like that joke? All right. That's a joke for our listeners of the show. Well, can you comment at all on the state of mind of Jerry during this time? I mean, this, you don't get much darker than the mood on this album.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he was pretty deep into his own personal demons at the time also, which explains some of the not showing up and
okay.
and some of the interesting calls I would get at different times to ready to work and that kind of stuff. So yeah, he definitely had a dark path during that. And as everyone knows now, he's in great shape and he's doing well and, mm-hmm. and they're having still having great success. So that's I'm so happy that's the way that turned out, because
yeah, you were not breaking any secrets that he was dealing with his own demons at that time. But
yeah,
know, so
yeah, and you know, it's you can't any record I've ever made, but one that took the time that took, you can't help but get really close to people and
yeah.
know people really well during that. Making records, somebody had said at one point, it's like a marriage. And so at the end, it's kind of sad because it's kind of breaking up and it's over.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
Well, it was also during the time we started that record because I'd spent about 3 years working with a producer, Paul Fox, out in Los Angeles and working at A&M. That was kind of our place. And I really just fell in love with the studio. So I knew when we were asked to do the record, I was asked to do the record that's where we were going to go. Well, we went through the whole cycle of all the way through it closing down and Henson buying it. So it's like, okay, well, this is the last day. So we did, it was kind of sad. And then it's like, okay, we have to find some studios. So we found some other places to kind of finish the recording of it. And then I get a call first part of January from the studio manager. It was A&M. When it turned to Henson, he said, we're back in business. He said, any chance you want to mix the record here? I said, absolutely. Cause the studio didn't change. It was the same gear and all that, mm-hmm. all that great stuff. Just the name changed. So it was nice to be able to go back to the familiar place and mix that record. Cause they've got a great mix room, always have.
Talk a little bit about the vibe in the studio. Was it somewhat up and down, or was it I'm trying to describe this a little bit. Like, would there be days where it was just like, we're not going to get shit done today because of and because you, like I said, you sat with this you worked with him a long time. I mean, was there a general kind of a dark vibe the whole time?
For the most part, yeah. I mean, there were some funny times in there, and when he was. You know, doing well, there were some funny times, and it was fun. I mean, every record that you ever make, there's I always said that you have a day or so that where you have what I used to call the lulls. I said, but we had weeks where we would do that at times. And so, and there was a point in the record where I just said, I walked away from it, and I called his, he didn't really have a manager at the time. He had a business manager, but he had his attorney. And the attorney's assistant, I finally called her and said, I'm going home. And she said, I talked to him actually. And he said, well, are you just, you're going home so you can kind of push him to get back into making the record? I said, no. I said, I'm going home because I can't do the job you've hired me to do. I said, I was home and I'd walked away from it, which was tough because we'd spent so much time on it. And they said, well, they contacted me in a couple of weeks and said, well, we're going to have to move forward. We're going to find somebody else to finish the record. And I said, fine. And so I pondered it for another couple of weeks. But a whole month went by, and I called them back, and they said, well, we haven't really found anybody. We're not really – haven't been actively looking. And I says, okay, I'm back in. I said, but here's the way it's got to be. Of course, it didn't wind up that way. Yeah. But at least I tried to lay down a little bit of structure to it.
Yeah, and I'm not going to put words in your mouth. These are mine. I'm starting to see what the issue was with Dave Jordan, maybe. Let me ask you this, because you actually just commented on something that I think was interesting on the amount of time you spend, and you get connected not only to the people, but how about the project? Were there times, because you're basically so deep into this, did the subject matter ever actually take a personal toll on you, like almost add a little weight to things? And I'm not saying in a sense that did it ever kind of depress you a little bit as you left the studio? It's like, Jesus, fuck.
Yeah. What are we doing? What's going on? There were certain times in the record where we were on totally different schedules, and, and he actually sat down and we had a discussion. He says, it's a funny story. Cause he said, here's what I think we need to do. Jerry said, I think we need to get pagers. That way I can page you whenever I says, no, I'm not going to do that. He says, come on, we can be like doctors. And I said, but we're not doctors. And I said, I need some sort of schedule. I said, I don't care when you want to work. I said, I don't care if you want to work the night shift, the grave, whatever. I said, but it needs to be consistent. He said, well, what are you talking about? I said, I don't know. Pick something. I said, let's say we start at 6 p.m. at night. And he said, okay, that sounds fine. And I said, but that means at 6 p.m. you got a guitar strapped on, we're plugged in, and we're ready to go. He says, well, you better make it 7. So that, you know, there was that kind of stuff. And we also ran a dad a lot of times to catch some of the funny, because he's a funny guy, some of the funny stuff he would say. And he was, for whatever reason, he was so hooked on those hot dogs from the convenience store hot dogs, which have to be disgusting. But that's all he wanted. And he would send a runner out, and he said, just make sure they're hot. And he says, I want two of those hot dogs, and I want, you know, relish, but dill pickle relish, not sweet pickle, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So
sounds like Jerry and I have the same taste in convenience store hot dogs.
If that's what you dig, then that
once in a while, man, those pieces of crap are just scrapping.
But you just can't do it all the time.
No, right. Yeah, that might be the distinction, huh?
But we did, you know, Anger Rising was a song that made me think about this, that he wrote with Chris DeGarmo from Queensryche. Mm. And Chris came down one day, and I was a huge Empire. I wore that CD out, you know, when it came out in the late 80s.
You and me both.
And so it was like, oh, man, Chris DeGarmo's coming here. So Chris shows up, and he said, where's Jerry? And I said, I don't know. He says, is he going to be here today? I said, I don't know. And he did. He wasn't. But anyway, he said, well, let me go ahead and put parts on here, because Jerry had asked me to come in and put some stuff on the song we wrote together. So he did. And that was just, you know, over. That was just a day, you know. And it was just a reel at times. There were times where people would pop in the studio. And I remember, well, what's the singer's name from Duran Duran? Simon Le Bon.
Simon Le Bon.
He came in, and he's talking to Robert. But he's hammered or whatever. But he's thinking Robert's Jerry, so he's talking to him about stuff like that. just different, you know. It was a sideshow at times. There was Twiggy Ramirez would hang out occasionally until I said he can't come here anymore, Jerry.
Yeah, bad influence on a bad influence. Yes. Who's the bad influence there?
I know it doesn't matter, but it was
Simon
like,
Le Bon hammered talking to it was DeGarmo. You're saying
talking to Robert Trujillo.
Oh, Robert, thinking Robert Trujillo of all yes. people is Jerry. Oh my Lord, that's a visual.
Because assistant engineer came over to me. He says, "Dude," he said, "that's." I said, "I know who that is." He says, "Well, he thinks that's Jerry. He's talking to him about the record."
Oh man.
I mean, Jerry's cut a wide path, and he had a lot of, you know, what's the bass player, Ben Shepherd from Stone Temple Pilots? Stone Temple Pilots.
Soundgarden.
Soundgarden came in to see him, and of course he wasn't there either. I mean, I'd get calls from Jerry's dad. In Oklahoma have a quarter horse ranch, and he'd call us, is Jerry there? And so I got to know his dad pretty well. No, sir, he's not here right now. He said, well, tell him to call me when he gets there.
Did you happen to see the cover before it came out?
No,
Man, that is a messed up cover, man.
It is messed up. That's, again, that's the mind of Jerry in that era.
It fits.
I mean, it fits completely. What's funny about it is, I don't know if it's in the back or somewhere, and it's the picture of the three guys, but they weren't together when they shot them. They were just, it was all Photoshopped together. Like, yeah. They took it.
Early days of Photoshop and Pro Tools, we're talking now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let me get your thoughts on a handful of the songs.
Okay.
Now, for the series I'm doing, I'm sticking to whatever Rolling Stone went with. This is one of the cases where the album they have on there is the original release, not the actual full-fledged release. But I do have a comment, especially on 3132, since I'm talking to you. I might as well get into that as well. But Bargain Basement, Howard Hughes, any thoughts on recording that one? Any memories there? Like, what do you think of the songs? Any of these questions I ask are really just any memories or anecdotes you have from that.
Well, that and Psychotic Break, I think, were one of the first couple that we cut. And just from the tracking of it, I just knew it was going to be this kind of just brutal, heavy sound, because just from what it is. But, you know, the lyrical content of it, of course, is so interesting, because some of the – I think Jerry had kind of walked the path as Howard Hughes did at some point, because there were certain things that if you watch that movie that – well, Leonardo DiCaprio played, Jerry kind of had that. There were things that went on in that movie when he kind of became a recluse that Jerry kind of mirrored. So, and which I think he did that, he had done that prior anyway. I know he did, not, I don't think, prior to showing up at the studio when he was writing the record. He's just pretty much, he said, I locked myself in my house, didn't go out. I had food brought in. He said, didn't get out of bed for days, that kind of stuff.
Wow.
And to be honest with you, that's how we did vocals. He said, when I did vocals, he said, I was real comfortable just kind of laying in my bed and holding the mic. And I said, okay. So I sent a runner out and they bought a futon. Down store down the street from A&M, and it just fit in the vocal booth. Mm. And I said, okay, I don't care if you want to stand on your head, because I've always had that thought process. It's whatever it takes to get a vocal. I don't care what you want to do. You want to be naked? That's fine too. I don't care. And so we did that for a little bit, where we shoved that bed in there, turn all the lights out, and he just, you know, I don't know how you sing, how you get a breath, how you can sing like that, but I'm not a singer, so what do I know?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Just an interesting story.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So that would have been used on this song for sure?
Yeah, yeah.
What about the single Anger Rising? I mean, another killer track.
I knew that was going to be the single from the first time I heard it, at least in my heart. I said, now that's a great song. And that's, you know, and that's obviously a song about him growing up and his dad and the struggles he and his mom went through with that, mm-hmm. with his dad and stuff. And he lost his mom years prior to us working together, and that was definitely obviously painful. I mean, you know, I lost mine about 8 years ago, so I understand now. But anyway, it's that was kind of the idea with that song, and so again, I think that it was a really strong melody and it was a really strong riff. The problem with that song was it was too long. It was like 5.5 minutes long, and we didn't cut it down because Jerry wasn't willing to change his arrangements. Well,
clocks in at 6 minutes and 14 seconds, Jeff.
Okay, well, there you go. But we did cut it down because the A&R
That's
said,
the
we've
cut.
Got to cut
da-
it down.
Oh, for the single they did. Okay.
For the single, it got cut down. But I wasn't involved in it. I wish I had been, because the edit's pretty not good. Okay. But anyway.
All right.
And he said, can we get it down to 3.5? And I told him, I said, no. So they'll never get the 3.5. What it was as a single was, I don't know, 418. I can't remember exactly, but they did cut it down, and then he shot a video for it. That was the first video. The song, just real quickly, that song, She Was My Girl, that's on there. I don't know if it's on the main one of the double.
It is, yes.
It was on the Spider-Man soundtrack.
Before?
Yeah. Well, no, not before. It was on the Spider-Man. Went on one of the Spider-Man.
Okay, movies. After the album was released?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And so it was like, okay, this is great. This will be a good advertiser for this, because there's other artists that are going to be involved in it. But it didn't. So. Which is another good song. That was the closest to a pop song I think Jerry's ever written, in my mind.
That had a very Stone Temple Pilots vibe, if you don't mind me saying.
I said, this is a pop song. This is total pop.
Yeah. I had that on my list to ask you about, so thank you for getting into that. But
yeah, so I get ahead of myself.
Whatever. Yeah.
What's the song? Hell. What is it? Hell.
But then it's copacetic. She's a duck girl. Is that?
Oh no, that's another. Yeah, that's another killer song. That's. She Was My Girl.
Okay.
I'm thinking of Hellbound.
Oh, which, the killer fucking track.
Just had an incredibly long intro, and I told him, I said, we got to cut the intro down. It's taking, you know, and I just was never into that song. And I guess the word got back to Jerry. Somebody said it, people talk in the studio. He says, so you don't like this? I said, it's just, you know, I'm more of a pop single kind of guy as far as editing goes.
Okay.
But anyway, he says, well, I'm thinking maybe I sell it to Ozzy. Maybe Ozzy would be a good song for Ozzy. So. Never happened. It got on the record and never got edited down. It is what it is. But Spider Bite. Now that's another. That's another just brutal kind of heavy, you know, riff rock song.
Was there any talk about any of this stuff being written to do with Alice in Chains, or was that like basically was Jerry just aware that Lane was just never going to be back?
Yeah, he was totally aware. This was never going to be. I talked to him. I remember talking to him after the record and said, yes, it's interesting. Some of the people either say it sounds too much like Alice in Chains or it doesn't sound enough. I said, you can't win. And I said, but it's sounding too much like Alice in Chains. The fact is that he was Alice in Chains.
Right.
He wrote all those those close harmonies, all that stuff. That's Jerry. I said, where'd you learn to do that kind of stuff? He said, boys choir.
Man. So, I think this would have been a brilliant Alice in Chains album. I love the record, but if you would have, in a perfect world, I'm saying,
but
this would have been a great sequel to Dirt. I think this would rival anything they've done since that record. I honestly do. I think, you know, especially going back to it now, I forgot, you know, like how good it was. It's just like there's really some strong stuff on here, and I might think it's a little bloated, but there is so many things to dissect in this thing, and it sounds like you're kind of getting to there. But can I circle back?
It's a deep record.
Can I get back to Anger Rising? I just wanted to make one comment, and that was that the way that melody, Alabama Trailer Park, that part, like the verse melody, goes over that rhythm is one of the most perfect things ever written in rock and metal. It flows so smoothly. It's just. I bet that came to him in like 10 seconds.
Well, he was so fast with parts and harmonies and melody and stuff. And he'd go in the booth. And what I mentioned Spider Bite is he'd lay down a part and then he'd lay down another harmony and another one. And he says, all right, give me another track. I said, you can't have another harmony there. and not that you can't, there's no way. He'd be like, what are you going to put? And he'd come up with another harmony. And it's just his sense of harmony and melody is pretty amazing.
Now this kind of ties into a question I have about the sequencing of the two different releases. I don't know when the album came out. Obviously, I probably until about the last few years, I had no idea that this was actually conceptually different. I didn't know why they did the second version. But the album ends with Gone, which to me is a perfect closer. And if you look at the 14 track listing, when you listen to this album, it sounds like an album that was sequenced and written and recorded like this is how it's supposed to be. So, first of all, what are your thoughts on the song Gone? I absolutely love it.
Love it. I got to say, I'm such a fan of the ballady kind of mellower.
Okay.
That's almost country. You know,
it really is.
It's got that kind of vibe to it. As a matter of fact, on Gone, was it Gone? No, Gone's the one he's playing as a dobro, as an acoustic, and it was just a cheap dobro too. As a matter of fact, but it just seemed to work in that song. But that one I'm drawing a blank on the name. The other ballad that's got the tremolo effect on the vocals of. Lord, I can't remember. But anyway, I like all of those in the
Solitude. No, that's not it.
Solitude. That's it. Yep. And the challenge, though, on like Gone and 31-32, Mike Borden's a great rock drummer. He's a pounder. But when you get him to try to play light and sensitive and that kind of thing, it was a challenge. And I would say, look, you got to play just like you're just dropping the stick on the snare head. You can't just pound it like you do on everything else. So, I mean, you can't relearn stuff like that in the studio. And so it was a challenge to mix it and get it to sound more like a ballad and not have that rock and roll kick drum and that, you know.
Well, that as good as a closer is, that I couldn't believe when I actually heard the resequenced record, it actually flowed much better. And 31-32 might be, I mean, especially for this record, it is just, well, first of all, it's depressing as fuck.
Yeah.
But it is, let me just read the opening lyrics and then I'll let you kind of take it from there. You were voted most likely to have your name go up in lights. Only took a few years to see that through. Now you're most likely to end up dead alone in a hotel room. 31-32. I like third room. I love that way he sings that room there.
Yes.
At the end there. But
little falsetto. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, he's like singing it so happy, but it is the most depressing fucking thing, you know, it. And again, like the message here actually kind of, it grabs you. It takes you down. It's 31-32. He's like, yeah, he's going to die around now. 31-32. That's what he's trying to say there. Right.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay.
And not just, I mean, not just speaking of Lane, but Jerry was on that path. And he even said that he kind of figured that would be his path also. It's just it's just such like you said, depressing, but it's such a great song. And you get to that part with the commander. What's the line, commander? Anyway, it's a the lyric is based on, he said that's what they called him when he was a kid. But it's just got to, again, the melodies are amazing. I actually had a couple of the girls that worked at the front A&M come back and listen to it one night after the mix was done, and they just turned the lights down, closed their eyes, and it's a long song, and a lot of people don't have that attention span, and they just like cried after it. Like, wow, yeah, that's a great song. And I said, that could have been a sound on a sound, anything. Again, it was not a song that you could cut down, because it tells a story, and there's no way to edit. You can't change the story like that.
No, I get it. Yeah, and he just had a remarkable way of singing and writing lyrics and combining the melody that would just make something so dark sound so beautiful at the same time.
Yes. Yeah, that's well put. That's exactly where that song is, and there's some pleading vocals in there that just it's like when somebody says, "I believe you," you know, "I believe it."
Yeah, there you go. Oh man. Well, looking back on the album, where would you stack it in your career? How do you feel about it now? Do you go back to it at all? Listen to it, or?
I haven't in years, but when I do listen to it, it always makes me smile. It's like, wow. An interesting thing about the record, too, is you're always your own worst critic, and I think I could have done that better in the mix and all that stuff. But the interesting thing is, and maybe we're a little bit ahead of all that stuff, but there aren't any drum samples on that. And as a matter of fact, Mike plays a Yamaha kit, and the president of a Yamaha came out and commented on how great the kick drum sounded, which I thought was pretty cool. Because that's just a stock, you know, it's his signature drum kit, no samples, you know, it's atypical of what we became, you know, music-wise and mixers and everything. We're like, all right, let's grab a sample, that'll make that sound better.
Wow. Do you stay in contact with Jerry at all, or?
I had for a while, and I have it. The last time I talked to him, they came through Atlanta, but this was when William was with them, but gosh, it's been their first tour, so it was three records ago. So been that many years that I hadn't talked to him.
Well, have you dug the stuff that he's done with William?
Oh man, I tell you what, when the first record came out that with William, Nick Raskolnikov did those records, and just a buddy of mine says it just the guitars sound like a giant hug. They're just so big and warm and just. You know, I think those records sound amazing. I think the songs are just, and it's funny, you know, William was in a band called Comes with the Fall, and they were based out of Atlanta for a bit. And anyway, William and the rest of the band would come to the studio and get, you know, they were friends with Jerry and stuff. So when Jerry went out and did his tour, when the record came out, that was his band. They'd do their Comes with the Fall set, and then they'd stay out, and Jerry'd just jump up in with his guitar and front man, and they'd continue on. So it was an odd kind of tour, I guess you could say.
Wow. Yeah, that's kind of – well, you know, as much as William is the vocalist in the band, really Jerry, as far as – especially with the new material, takes a more of a frontal approach than he did when it was Lane in the band. So William almost is kind of there to kind of help with the back catalog more than he is to kind of be a replacement for Lane on new material.
It's still always going to be Jerry's band, in my estimation. Even when it was Lane, now Jerry had learned so much from Lane, and there's nobody sings like Lane.
No,
so there was no question of that. But I exactly what you're saying. It's like it's still Jerry's band, and Jerry's going to do. You know, somebody's got to run the show. As Ted Nugent says, there's only room for one alpha male in that. That's one of my favorite comments, quotes, and Ted's got a million of them.
Yeah, unfortunately. No, sorry. now I lost my train of thought. Did you ever meet Lane? Did you ever have a chance?
I talked to him on the phone. That was it. I never got to meet him. And that was Jerry's prompting, because Jerry had called him up after he'd played him the stuff and said, "Here, you got to hear what Lane has to say." And I talked to him for, I don't know, 5 minutes. That was about it. Really short conversation.
Okay.
We had one interesting thing to note is when he was looking for a label, when we were during the mix process, he was looking for a label and thinking about signing to something with Metallica had a label or an imprint or something at that point. So Lars came by one night and he said, where's Jerry? You know, he said hi and all that stuff. He says, where's Jerry? I says, he's down in the artist lounge down there for the mix room. So he walks down there and comes back. Says, any other idea? And I said, nope. And so that was that. And he says, you know, I'd like to hear some of the stuff. And he said, but here's what I want you to do on the mixes. And so he's telling me, he says, I want these versions of the mixes. I want one with a kick drum up 2 dB, one up with kick drum up 4 dB, and one up 6, right? And then I want it backwards down, all that. And then I want the snare drum. So he wanted like 20 mixes. And so when Jerry shows up after Lars was gone, I says, are you signing with Lars? He says, I don't know. I said, well, he wants all these alternate mixes. As we're going to spend 6 months mixing this record if we do that. And he says, screw that. We're not doing that.
Yeah, I've heard Michael, I'm not going to get his name right, Barbario or something like that. The guy who mixed, he was an engineer on Injustice for All. Maybe it's not even the right guy. Maybe it's
Michael Barbiero. He also did the Guns N' Roses. He mixed Appetite. If you're talking about Barbiero, yeah,
it might be. It might be Steve Thompson. Isn't that his partner?
Yep.
Okay,
yep.
One of those two guys, and if they happen to hear this, my apologies. You reminded me of that. One of those guys was on another show, and he talked about mixing with Lars, and they brought up the bass thing, you know, on that record, and he's like, take it down 7 dB, and it's just kind of funny that you're actually telling the same kind of vernacular in how he speaks, and it's like, wow. Because I don't know about you, like when I'm sliding a mixer, I'm not really necessarily going precisely 2 dB. I'm kind of I'm getting it to where my ear says that sounds about right.
It was also interesting to note that all his comments were about mixes with different drum mixes. Didn't have anything with the vocals, anything else that's, you know. I guess if I had it to do over again, I was talking about some regrets, is the way I had it mixed, Jerry kept saying, the vocals are too loud. He says, I want them riding in the car, not on top. So people have to hear the lyric.
Yep.
And so I listen to some of that sometimes and cringe a little bit, thinking the vocals are probably a little bit low. But again, those are compromises you make making a record. You know?
You're probably nitpicking yourself a little bit there, because I really don't hear too many flaws production-wise on this thing. I think it sounds amazing.
Well, that's good. I appreciate that. The second round of mastering was a major chore, because the A&R guy was, you know, just wearing me out. He says, now we've got two different mastered versions where George tweaked the high frequency an eighth of a dB. And which one do you like? I says, I can't hear an eighth of a dB.
Yeah.
I said, they're both the same if you ask me. I said, how are you listening to this? He says, well, I listen on my headphones really loud, so I can only listen like 2 minutes of the song because my ears shut down.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Exactly.
Then you can't hear an eighth of a dB either. You know, you were talking about real quick about tape edits and stuff. Well, I remember them talking about, I think by Barbiero, maybe in an interview or something, that you can hear a lot of the tape edits where the cymbals cut off a little bit because, you know, you don't have Pro Tools, you can't change things. So,
oh, right.
Just an
yeah.
interesting footnote.
I think it might be the same interview we're talking about. Yeah, because he's like, that's one of the reasons they can't go back and remaster it, is because like that the drum track tape would just be falling into little pieces on the floor.
I know records perfect. I hear records, I know that's beautiful, that's awesome. But in my mind, it's just, you know, you make a record and you go after the emotion and you let everything else kind of fall where it falls.
You know, I like that too. You know what I mean? I touched on Kiss a little earlier. I'm a huge Kiss fan. I don't know how familiar you are with the album Hotter Than Hell, but it's a very controversial record because it sounds like shit. But I actually really enjoy the sound. To me, I don't want it to change. But I acknowledge why people don't think it. Yeah, it's not a smooth sounding record, but I kind of like that. You know, and sometimes if you capture it just right, I mean, it works. You know, at least for
you
some
capture
people.
Capture the emotion. I'm a huge Kiss fan too, and they were actually mixing that record Psycho Circus at one point when I was working at A&M across the hall. So it was, to me, it was like, oh my gosh! And you'd see Gene and he, you know, in Ace and Paul a couple of times, and the coolest thing was going down the hallway and seeing they had their guitar set up in case they need to fix anything, and there's that Bad Lax bass all beat up.
Oh yeah.
You know, and there's the Iceman. I'm going, you know, I graduated in 1979, so they were just, that was the band. Mm. You know. So to say that many years later, say I'm standing in front of Gene's Cadillac space, or Gene's sitting in the front lobby area typing,
you know? Eating a bagel.
It's just surreal, you know.
Can't help but notice you didn't mention you ran into Peter.
No, Peter wasn't around, it didn't seem like.
All right, fair enough. You're the best. Great stories, good stuff. People are going to just love this. So,
good.
I really appreciate getting back to me and letting us arrange this. So,
yeah, let me know if I can help out anymore.
All right, man, all the best. You have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Welcome to the program. Real quick, it's Jeff Tomei, right?
Or
Tomei. See, I was like Marissa Tomei, and for some reason my mind just said Tomei right there. But yeah, Tomei. All right, just want to make sure I say your name right.
Yeah, she's helped by her fame has helped out the pronunciation after years. I'm 59, so after years of it being mispronounced, which is obvious.
Yeah,
she's like, okay, great. Now you got it. That's it.
All right. I get bacon or backin.
Yeah, right.
So, but yeah, it's a cross we all bear to a certain extent. No big deal. All right. I'd like to welcome to the program producer, engineer, and a mixer of all sorts of I'll get into your artists here in a little bit, but you're here to talk about the Jerry Cantrell record. Of course, I'm talking about Jeff Tomei. I almost fucked it up there again. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.